I'm Dean Reuter, General Counsel and Senior Vice President of the Federalist Society. I am sometimes, I'll answer a question that I'm sometimes asked, and that is, as the General Counsel of the Federalist Society, what is your role? And it's only when I see something remotely legal, I call one of you people. So I have the easiest General Counsel job in the world because I have thousands of outside counsel. But welcome today to our conversation with Vice President Mike Pence. This is our final substantive event in Executive Branch Review 11. Cannot believe we've been doing this conference for 11 years. And I never failed to mention that we called the first one the first annual Executive Branch Review Conference, pretty confident that this would be the first in a series. We're at 11 and counting, and we still haven't solved the administrative state, so we'll be back next year as well. I want to take just a moment to thank and congratulate the staff, including Nate Kaczmarek, Julie Nix, and all the Federalist Society staff who worked so hard to put this event together. If you could give them a round of applause. And now to our conversation. Mike Pence was born in Columbus, Indiana, one of six children. And this after his grandfather immigrated to the United States when he was 17 years old. His mother and father built a family business, and a great name, and they instilled in him the virtues of hard work, faith, and family. He attended Hanover College, where he earned a bachelor's degree, and then went on to Indiana University School of Law, earning a law degree, but probably more importantly, meeting the love of his life, Second Lady Karen Pence. After graduating, he practiced law, led the Indiana Policy Review Foundation, and began hosting the Mike Pence Show, aptly named, syndicated talk radio show and weekly television public affairs program, building his name. He and his wife are the father of three children. In 2000, the year 2000, he ran successfully for Congress from Indiana and won that seat six times. He had a major initiative as a congressman to help make government smaller and more effective. Something we've been discussing today, and for the past 11 years, frankly. In 2013, he was elected the 50th governor of the state of Indiana. And then in July 2016, Donald Trump selected Mike Pence as his running mate, and they were together elected on November 8th, 2016, after which he served as vice president. He's now an author, and we'll talk about his book in a moment. But now, please join me in welcoming the 48th vice president of the United States, Mike Pence. So let's just jump right into it, if we could, with your indulgence. You've been, as I noted in the introduction, a congressman, a governor, and vice president. Can you talk about the relative pros and cons, the positives, the negatives of those various roles for a minute?
Gee, how much time do we have?
Let's focus on the positives.
Well, first, let me just thank the Federalist Society. Thank you so much for the warm welcome today. Thank you for that that warm, overly generous introduction. But more importantly, I want to thank the men and women of the Federalist Society for the stand that you take as officers of the court every day for the Constitution of the United States of America. God bless you all. We're just honored to be here with you. And I must tell you, that, you know, for me to have been able to serve in the Congress of the United States and serve as governor of Indiana and have the great privilege of serving as your vice president has been an incredible journey for me. And one that I had the privilege of capturing in my recent memoir entitled So Help Me God, which I don't know if I mentioned that I wrote a book recently, but I'm contractually obligated to mention it to you. So. But for me, I really feel like a guy that had the opportunity to take a journey through the form of government that our founders contemplated, to be part of the legislative branch, to be in the lawmaking process was a great privilege for me. I served both in Republican majorities and in minorities and actually was part of winning back the majority in 2010. I served under a president of my own party and a president of the other party and learned the dynamics of the House of Representatives. But then my life took me to returning to Indiana, where I served as governor, and there really came to appreciate the dynamic nature of the Federalist system that our founders enshrined. You know, to understand the Constitution of the United States, many people will point to the 10th Amendment that says that the powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states and to the people. But in many ways, I feel that the 10th Amendment is just an exclamation mark at the end of a document that up to that point was all about limited government. And it was as though if you had missed the point, we want to say it one more time in this Bill of Rights, that this is a system. I love what Ronald Reagan said in his first inaugural address, that it's important to remember that the states created the federal government. The federal government didn't create the states. And I must tell you, the opportunity to have gone home and been a part of one of those laboratories of innovation and to see what we were able to do with regard to education reform, with regard to healthcare reform, and a broad range of areas really gave me a great sense of the vitality of our system. And when I became vice president, I tried to carry that same experience from both the Congress of the United States and as governor into our administration. And I'm very proud that our administration was able to move legislation that advanced freedom. We moved legislation that pulled back on the regulatory state, much focus of this conference today. We unleashed American energy. We secured our border. But beyond all of that, we also gave great flexibility to the states, particularly when it came to what's known as waivers, giving states the capacity to try new ideas, particularly when it came to Medicaid. Much of that's been undone by the Biden administration with very little public notice in the media, but it's occurred. That the flexibility that we had given to states during the Trump-Pence administration has been pulled back. But all along the way, I just feel like for me, each element of our government has their own has their own role. But to have been able to serve in the legislative branch, in the executive branch at the national level, but also to serve as a chief executive of a state just reminded me of how dynamic our system is and how that the framework of our founders from the very outset is still vital and important and holds the keys to a boundless American future.
Very good. I mentioned in my introduction that this is the Federalist Society's 11th Executive Branch Review Conference, where we try to take a close-up examination of the administrative state. I also mentioned your initiative for a smaller and more effective government. That, of course, reminds me of a very quick joke. It involves two people who worked at an agency, and one asked the second one, it's like, how many people work at your agency? And the other one said, the second one said to the first one, about half. I've been involved in government agencies. I've worked for the federal government before, and I know that many people work very, very hard. But I'm wondering, from those three perches you have, if you want to say a little bit more about the administrative state. As a congressman, you probably were involved in delegating some authority to administrative actors. As a governor, you were the recipient of federal funds, maybe with some federal strings that came from agencies. And then as the vice president, you had a role overseeing all of it. Do you want to dig down any deeper on the administrative state itself? And then we'll turn to your book.
Well, I think restraining and reclaiming the legislative prerogatives of the legislative branch from the administrative state should be one of the most important objectives of the next Republican administration. I believe it with all my heart. I mean, when you need look no further than a recent case, I can reflect on one that our foundation became involved in, where the FDA 20 years ago bypassed their own rules and the requirements of the law to approve mifepristone. And then for 20 years, with many women around the country, hundreds and hundreds of documented cases in the first few years of women suffering severe consequences, nearly a dozen documented deaths in the face of mifepristone. Then the FDA, under the Obama administration, ceased collecting data on negative health outcomes apart from fatalities. And I just really believe this is, number one, I'm pro-life. I don't apologize for it. I couldn't be more proud to have been a small part of the administration that appointed three of the justices that sent Roe versus Wade to the ash heap of history where it belongs and gave us a new beginning for life. But in this instance, this to me is as much about the cause of the unborn and the cause of protecting women, but it's also about reining in an administrative state. I mean, it was 20 years ago, as Mark Weed, a great Federalist Society member who's on our American Freedom team, wrote in his amicus brief in that case, literally the FDA used emergency provisions that were enacted to facilitate addressing the HIV crisis 25 years ago to approve mifepristone. It was a demonstrably political move driven by politics and not by science. But it's just one example of legions of examples where the administrative state has overreached and essentially usurped a legislative authority. It's one of the reasons why I think one of the most important bills to be passed by the Congress was actually written by a predecessor of mine, who was, if memory serves, one of the co-founders of the Federalist Society. The former Congressman David McIntosh wrote what came to be known as the Congressional Review Act in the late 1990s. We would use it a number of times during the Republican majority to undo famous, there were these famous ergonomic rules regarding chairs that were about to cost businesses hundreds of millions of dollars. We were able to rescind that. And it was very recently that President Biden used his first veto pen to veto a Congressional Review Act effort to undo the imposition of environmental, social, and governance provisions in investing in America. It's extraordinary. The President of the United States literally put their radical climate liberal agenda ahead of pensioners and hardworking Americans' interests with that veto pen. And I would submit to you that I believe that the efforts by Republicans and what became a bipartisan bill in the United States Senate made its way to the President's desk, was sadly vetoed. But this is a battle that, to me, it's one of the reasons I love attorneys in the Federalist Society, because everything begins with the Constitution. Under our form of government, that first job that I had in public life is where the laws get made, right? And you all understand the precedents of Chevron and other major precedents that gave excessive latitude. It was one of the reasons why, when I was participating in the interviews for our first opening on the Supreme Court of the United States, I was enamored. I will tell you, we have no greater champion of reining in the administrative state than Justice Neil Gorsuch, and I'm proud to have seen him added to the Supreme Court of the United States. It's hope for the future. But it's one of the great challenges of our time, to say the least.
Very good. Let's turn to your book, if we could. I think we're all familiar with the phrase, "So help me God." Can you tell us a little bit about why you chose that as the title for this book?
Well,
I'm contractually obligated to say this will be for sale across the hall after we're done here, and the Vice President has agreed to sit and sign copies for us.
Be delighted to. And thank you for mentioning my book. I don't know if I mentioned
I'll put it right here.
That I had a book come out last fall. The title of the book was really inspired in two ways. First, while this is a story of our lives, in so many ways, it's really a story of God's faithfulness in my life. If you read the pages of this book, you'll find the most important decision I ever made was when I put my faith in Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. It changed my life forever in 1978, and I couldn't write my story without reflecting on God's grace in my life. From the time that I met the girl of my dreams, and we got to take a shot at politics, our little family came along, and then eventually we would have the chance to serve in public life. But all along the way, it really, for me, the title of the book is So Help Me God. The last three words are Thank You, Jesus. And so that's the core of that inspiration. The other inspiration for it really came from the oath of office that I had the privilege of taking many times. History records that when President George Washington took the first oath of office as the first president of the United States, that he added four words, So Help Me God. And history and tradition has continued that throughout the years, not just for presidents, but for members of Congress, for governors. I'm proud to say that my son Michael is a captain in the United States Marine Corps. My son-in-law Henry is a lieutenant in the United States Navy. They're both fighter pilots, and they both took the same oath of office that I took. And for me, it's always been since my youth when I first began to study the Constitution in the in a high school speech contest. And as I write in the book, it began for me a lifelong love affair with the Constitution, which is the greatest charter of human freedom in the history of the world, the Constitution of the United States. And all throughout my career, I've sought to formulate and articulate a political philosophy that's ultimately grounded in the Constitution. Throughout my years of service and through some difficult days at the end of our administration, I tried to keep the oath that I made because I believed it was an oath that I took and pledged not just to the American people, but to Almighty God. And so the inspiration of this book is born of God's faithfulness, but also my effort throughout my life to live out my oath to the Constitution of the United States. And always do that, So Help Me God.
You might already have answered this question in my previous question, but what do you want people to take away from this book as they read it?
Well, I hope that they take away from this book a great sense of pride about this country. I mean, even through the most difficult days of my public service, our institutions held. Our Constitution held. And as I said at the end of the book, one of the difficult part for me is seeing much of the progress that we made, that I fought for in my years in Congress and as governor and as vice president, seeing much of the progress that we've made undone by an administration in less than 2.5 years. I mean, it's extraordinary to think of whether it be the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan, whether it be the war on energy, whether it be undoing our policies that had secured the border, whether it be the gusher of needless federal spending that's ignited the worst inflation in 40 years. It's a time that it's easy for Americans to be concerned about the future. But as I say at the end of the book, I hope when people read in the pages of this book about a small-town guy that got to live the dream and serve in the second highest office in the land, that the challenge we simply have is we just got to have government as good as our people again. We got to have government that's just as committed as the American people are to our highest ideals. And I believe we will, and we will someday soon. So help us God.
Let me ask you what might be a personal question, but in the book,
last one was pretty personal.
Well, this might go even deeper, but family is a big part of this book, particularly your father.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm wondering about the impact he had in your life, and would you think it's more than a typical father and son relationship? And a subpart of that question is a lot of people when they write a book, they've got somebody in mind. They're writing it to someone. They're writing it for someone. Say more about that if you could.
Well, I love the second question because no one's ever asked me that. You'd be surprised how many interviews you do about a book that you write that are conducted by people that didn't read the book. You know, I really did. I actually was thinking of my grandkids when I was writing the book. Karen and I became grandparents for the first time 3 times over in the last 2 years. And that's what we call in our family a good start. I mean, all the blessings I've had in my life, the privileges I've had to serve our country, I mean, who would have imagined that I would also be grandfather to the 3 most beautiful little girls ever born in the history of the world? I mean, just statistically, I'm saying, just think of the odds of that. But I was writing it for Avery and Elena and Etta Rose. I really was. You know, none of us are promised tomorrow. I wanted them to understand this story and our family story. As you graciously point out, someone said to me when I was turning in manuscripts for this book, they said, you know, we think your dad is the secret star of this book, which I just loved. My dad left us in 1988. He was 58 years old. I wasn't even out of my 20s yet. But he's the best man I ever knew. Combat veteran in the Korean War. He came home, he married this first generation Irish-American redhead who's 90 years young to this day. I can't keep up with my mom. I really can't. They followed work down to a small town in Indiana. They were a couple of big city kids, and they really lived the American dream. As you said, I like to say my dad built everything that matters, a family, a business, and a good name, and he did. He did. But he raised me and my 3 brothers and 2 sisters, with just some core values. My dad wasn't very political at all. I mean, as I often tell people, my dad was a businessman. He just was nominally Republican, right? But a patriot. He loved this country, believed in America. But honestly, he had no use for politicians or lawyers. So you can imagine I was a great source of pride to him. But I must tell you that when he left us suddenly, a heart attack, at age 58, it was easily the worst day of my life, by a lot. But he continues to be one of the greatest influences in my life to this day. Writing the book, having the chance to tell not just my story, but to tell Karen and my story, to tell my dad's story, to tell the story of my grandfather who stepped off on a boat onto Ellis Island in 1923. I mean, think about that. I mean, that Richard Michael Cawley, you know, steps off onto Ellis Island, signs himself in, goes to Chicago, Illinois, drives a bus for 40 years, and his grandson and namesake, Michael Richard Pence, goes on to be Vice President of the United States. Is this a great country or what? So it was I love your question about who I wrote it for, because I've never answered that question till today.
Good.
Wrote it for my granddaughters, but thanks for asking about my dad. I hope people are as inspired by his example as I continue to be.
It's an extraordinary story, and thank you for sharing it. We're technically out of time, but I have 2 more questions I want to get to, if we could. First, is there a backstory, and can you share it, about how you came to be President Trump's running mate in 2016? That's a backward-looking question, and then we'll finish with a more forward-looking question, if we could.
Well, I remember reporters used to ask me during the campaign in 2016, they used to say, what's the most surprising thing about your campaign? You know, for vice president. And I said, you mean other than the fact that I'm in it? I remember when we got the call that from a friend of a friend who said, a friend of mine was wondering if you might want to be considered as a possible vice presidential pick. I was taken aback.
And full disclosure, I had supported another candidate in the Indiana primary in 2016. And in fairness, Ted Cruz won all three counties I campaigned with him in. And Donald Trump won the other 89. I didn't think I was on the call list, if you will. But we got the call, and it was very interesting to me. Karen and I immediately took the matter to prayer, which is where we always try and go first. And I contacted this mutual friend, and I said, well, in order to answer the question, I need to know a couple of things. I need to know them better, because we didn't know their family, and whatever we do as a family. And I said, secondly, I'd need to know what the job description is, right? I mean, I really enjoyed being governor and knew what I could do as a governor, but there's only one person that writes a job description for vice president, and they write it every 4 years, right? And so I said, you know, we need to spend some time with them, and that's not realistic. This was literally, just before the 4th of July, with the Republican National Convention coming up in a matter of weeks. I said, I'm sure it won't be possible. They called me back a day later and said, well, actually, I said, please tell them, don't be offended by my answer. This is an honest answer from my heart. And they called back the next day and said, well, not only was he not offended, he loved your answer. And he wanted to invite you to Bedminster, bring your family. Their family's going to be there this weekend. They want to spend the whole weekend with you and spend time and talk about all of this, which we did. We traveled to Bedminster and arrived there on a Friday evening and then spent the better part of the weekend talking through not just his ideas about the role of the vice president, which could be summed up in one word, as I wrote in my book. He said, active. And I said, active. And he said, yeah, I mean, you were a congressman. I want you to be active in Congress. I want you to be active around the country. I want you to be active around the world. You're on the Foreign Affairs Committee. You be active. And I have to tell you, after 4 years as your vice president in the Trump-Pence administration, that's what we call a promise made, promise kept, okay? It was active. But I felt there was, Karen and I both felt a great ease with their family, which surprises a lot of people. Some people think we're a little bit different. But honestly, we had an almost immediate rapport, and I had a sense that that we could help. I had a sense of his commitment to an agenda of less taxes and more freedom and conservatives on our courts, with that famous publication of the list of exclusively Federalist Society potential nominees. You can applaud that if you like. Did it again. Commitment to a strong national defense, you know, with military in our immediate family. And so I'll never forget the night the phone rang. It would be about a week after we came home, and they visited Indiana, and I got the heads up that you're going to get the call tonight. And we thought it was going to be an invitation to join the ticket. And I was standing in my study at the governor's residence. My wife was at my side, and a few of our aides were there. The phone rang, I picked it up, and I heard that familiar voice say, Mike, it's going to be great. And then he went into it. He said, you know, look, we're going to turn this country around. And when I go north, you go south, I go west. We're going to have to work. We're going to have to go out. He talked for like 7 minutes straight, never said a word. And I said, well, if there's a question in there, the answer is yes. And he said, oh, no, yeah, right. No, I want you to do it. So great memories, great experiences, and an incredible sense of privilege. But one that we never saw coming.
Great. Well, final question here, and this one's going to take us back in time, but also have a forward-looking aspect. It's again from the book, So Help Me God. In there, you describe a meeting that took place at the Capitol Police Chief's office on 9/11. And you make the observation that there were no Republicans, no Democrats. There was this feeling of unity, and it really did pervade the country for months, maybe years afterwards. That seems to have been lost. It seems like ancient history at this point in time. I wonder if you have thoughts about whether we can get back to that sort of feeling, even as we celebrate differences. Is it possible to reclaim that without a national disaster or an attack or something like that?
Well, the short answer is yes. We just got to have government as good as our people. I mean, look, the American people are the most idealistic, generous, compassionate, respectful people on the face of the earth. I've traveled all across this country, big cities and small towns, and I tell people sometimes, with all due respect to those of you who work in Washington, you know, you get 15 miles out of Washington, D.C., the people in this country actually get along pretty well, right? I think our politics is more divided than ever before. I don't mean to diminish that. But I'm not convinced the American people are as divided as our politics. And I think if we'll raise up leadership that will express our highest ideals, I think the American people will rally to our cause. I saw it not just on 9/11, when the smoke was still billowing from the Pentagon and from Ground Zero and from a field outside Shanksville, Pennsylvania. But frankly, I saw it in the immediate days at the outset of the COVID pandemic. Traveling to Capitol Hill, partisanship was gone for a while. People were interested. Before at the beginning of those, sometimes I've heard people write about real combat and talk about the fog of war. And some of the veterans in the room will understand that better than I ever will. But it's this notion of not really knowing what's happening around you. And I can tell you from the time late February that I was tasked to lead the White House Coronavirus Task Force, it was a fog. We didn't know what we didn't know. We didn't know how dangerous it was. We didn't know how contagious it was. We didn't know who the vulnerable among us were. And in a very real sense, I sensed a spirit in those early weeks of genuine national unity. And I will tell you, there's a chapter in the book entitled Only in America. Because while there are lessons to be learned from our experience with COVID, particularly those surrounding personal freedom, and how I strongly oppose the Biden administration's mandate of vaccines and wish the Supreme Court would have undone all the mandates, including to our service members and healthcare providers. I do believe that what the American people accomplished during that time was a great tribute to a free society. I'll tell you a quick anecdote out of that time. And that is that once things kind of began to settle a little bit, about 3 weeks after we started leading the task force, some of the criticism began from Capitol Hill, from some Democrat quarters. They were asking why we weren't using what's called the Defense Production Act, which allows the government to order private businesses to create certain products in the time of national emergency, right? And the president had begun to attend the press briefings, and he got a question about it. Why aren't you using the Defense Production Act? And the president basically bought some time and said, we're looking at it, and let me get back with you tomorrow on that. And we were walking down the hall to the Oval Office, and he punched me in the side of the arm and said, why aren't we using the Defense Production Act? And I looked at him, as I write in my book, I looked at him and said, because nobody said no. And he stopped dead in his tracks. He looked at me and said, what? And I said, no business of any size in America that we have called to do anything has said no. Everyone has said yes, and nobody has ever asked how they're going to get paid for it. I mean, we had automotive companies that all of a sudden opened up lines to create ventilators because we were facing a dramatic ventilator shortage. In America, we knew that thousands of people had died in Italy because of a lack of ventilator equipment. And automotive companies dropped whatever they were doing and went to work. We had We had a apparel companies suddenly start to manufacture gowns and masks and gloves for healthcare workers. We saw the way that American industry stepped up, and it was a tribute. It was a tribute to free enterprise and a free society, and also a tribute to our national unity. I really do believe that there is today and has always been more that unites us in this country than could ever divide us. We just have to have leadership that will express our values in a principled way, but express them in a way that allows for the discovery of genuine common ground. People that know me know I'm a conservative, but I'm not in a bad mood about it, right? And I don't believe in compromising principle, but I do believe, as the late Russell Kirk wrote, that politics is the art of the possible. And when you look about this mountain range of debt facing those granddaughters of mine, it could literally go from $30 trillion to $150 trillion before they get out of college. When you look at the challenges facing us in the wider world today, and you look at the crisis at our border, you look at our economy, you look at the challenges facing the family and parents in America today, I believe that we as conservatives hold the keys. We hold the solutions for America, but our challenge is to express those in a way that allows us to move our nation forward, and I believe we can, and I believe we will.
Well, that's a good optimistic note to end on. Mr. Vice President, you've been very generous with your time and your thoughts and sharing your thoughts. I can't thank you enough. This has been brilliant. Thank you for your time. And to the audience, please join me in thanking the Vice President.
Thank you all very much. Honored to be back with the Federalist Society.